Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. On this week's show, marine fisheries expert and author Paul Greenberg demystifies the dead zone. He shares a dire prediction for what's happening this summer in the Gulf of Mexico, just off Louisiana's coast. Then, LSU Ag Seafood Specialist Dr. John Bell and Coastal Agent Thomas Email join us to unveil a new Louisiana seafood product, Vermilion Bay Sweets. And with all that seafood talk, we'll turn to Dr. Gourmet for cholesterol advice. The good news is, you'll just want to eat more shrimp. We're diving right into the water on this week's Louisiana Eats. If you're a regular Louisiana Eats listener, you're probably already familiar with our friend, writer Paul Greenberg. Paul has been working recently on some in-depth investigative reporting on the Gulf of Mexico's dead zone. Paul, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Hey, Poppy. Great to be back.
It's kind of an ominous topic.
The dead zone.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, wasn't it Stephen King that first coined that phrase?
I think so. So what is a dead zone?
It is water that has been rendered hypoxic by the blooming of algae and then its death and decomposition, which sucks oxygen out. The term dead zone really refers to large areas, but the larger dead zone that we're worried about right now is off of coastal Louisiana, and that's a direct result of huge amounts of fertilizer coming into the Mississippi all up and down the main stem of the river, stimulating the growth of algae. Huge blooms happen, huge die-offs happen, and then huge hypoxia happens.
Is that Gulf of Mexico dead zone the largest in size category?
Well, it's largest in the United States and I guess North America. The largest in the world is currently in the Baltic Sea. That is a direct result of just huge amounts of industrialization and agriculture and runoff that's going into a contained area. Now, the biggest one in the world that there ever was in the Black Sea, but that one disappeared.
And that was a river runs through it, so it was the Danube that was at fault there.
So the Black Sea dead zone is very similar to the situation in the Gulf of Mexico. Europe has this mighty river called the Danube, which is similar to our mighty Mississippi. And the Danube had agriculture and industrial development all along its stem, just like the Mississippi does. But what happened around the Danube is that they had complete societal collapse. All these socialist economies that were churning out all this fertilizer and industrial effluent, those economies crashed, and with them crashed the amount of fertilizer and other sort of nitrogen and phosphorus sources going into the river. And after that, the Black Sea dead zone radically shrank to almost nothing. So it shows you that if you turn off the nutrients, you can fix the dead zone.
Well, in researching our dead zone, you started where the Mississippi River begins, with a conventional corn and soybean farmer named Brian Hicks.
Yep.
What's Brian trying to do to solve the dead zone problem?
So Brian is a really bright guy, very engaged guy. He understands that it is runoff and fertilizer going into the river that is the problem. The main thing that he is trying to do is to fix something called tiling. So a tiling is, next time you fly over the United States and you look down on the agricultural fields below you, imagine what's below there. And what's below there is probably the country, if not the world's biggest plumbing network. In order to use fields early in the season, farmers wanted to get moisture out of that soil as soon as possible. And so they've laid pipe all underneath the Midwest. And what that pipe does is it directs all the excess water right into the nearest waterway, and all ends up in the Mississippi. Farmers tended in the past to just keep those pipes open all the time so that all the nutrients just flowed right out and dumped right into the Mississippi no matter what the water situation was. What Brian's doing is that he's working with the University of Minnesota to actually put valves on all the tile so that as much as possible he tries to keep the water in the soil long enough so that it has enough time to diffuse through the soil and retain some of those nutrients. And it ends up being a win-win situation because in the summertime, when other farmers' fields have gone dry, he's kept all that moisture in his soil, and it's ready to bubble up and be used by the crops.
Well, this particular effort is something that's supported by the USDA, but it's a voluntary effort, and you seem to sort of have a cynical view about what's really going on. What's the scoop on the real deal?
Well, basically, nobody wants to tell anyone what they have to do, right?
Right.
It's the quickest way to get voted out of office. meanwhile, environmentalists really actually do like to tell people what to do. It's part of their joy and bane in this world. Environmentalists would like to establish the total amount of nutrients that can go into the Mississippi and just say, boom, that's the limit. If you go over it, we're going to fine you. And this is, in fact, what they've done in the Chesapeake Bay, which also has a dead zone issue in it. This is something that strikes mortal terror into the hearts of Midwestern politicians and federal politicians. The last thing they want to do is say to some politically important farmer in Iowa, remember where the
yes.
Iowa caucus is occurring?
Oh, yes.
You do not want to be telling a farmer to shut off his tiling or else. So what they're doing with this voluntary program is they're saying, if you meet all of these standards by X date, you conceivably could get grandfathered in and be exempt from regulation should it eventually be forced down your throat. So that's the idea. It's a little bureaucratic. I'm sorry for that. But,
it is what it is.
That, as you say down in Louisiana, that's government.
That's it. Well, when you spoke with Tom Vilsack, the Secretary of Agriculture, and he pointed out the Obama administration's efforts to address the problem in the Upper Mississippi Basin Healthy Watersheds Initiative.
Yep.
Explain that initiative to us.
It basically is trying to turn everybody into Brian Hicks in the sense of we want everybody to have buffer strips along their fields so that the nitrogen gets filtered through. We want everyone to try and fix their tiling. We want people to use cover crops in the wintertime. And all these different practices, you know, are supported through different kinds of grants. There are even some schemes to do. Remember with carbon, there was all this idea of trading carbon credits?
Yes.
So now there's talking about possibly having a nitrogen market. There's actually a pilot program in Ohio where a power company is buying the credit from a group of Amish cheese farmers upriver.
Wow.
So they're basically continuing to put their nutrients into the water, but they pay the Amish farmers upriver, you know, a subsidy to have buffer strips, do all these protective measures. And the grand pie in the sky idea is that someday we could maybe work this out so that some people will sequester nitrogen, some people will release it, but through our combined efforts somehow come to a total maximum daily load that will be acceptable for the environment.
Well, as always in this world, so much of this has to do with dollars and cents. Paul, you believe that if the BP dollars were correctly distributed, that could solve the problem. So what do you think should be done with the BP money?
BP settlement money, what are we talking about? You know, $16, $17, $20 billion? It could be a lot of money. The area that I looked into was the question of the Louisiana marsh. You and I have discussed this before about how Louisiana is losing something like a third of a Manhattan a year in territory from subsidence, from the fact that the river's been levied, from the falling apart from the marsh, you know, after it's been canalized and pipelined and so forth. You know, I saw some very large state-funded projects where marshland is actually being rebuilt. There's some controversy as to the permanence of that land, but certainly a certain amount of money should be allocated from that BP situation to do whatever we can to shore up the marsh. The marsh suffered greatly during the spill. That front line of marsh grass is going to deteriorate as time progresses, and we have to really think about, you know, the marsh as this great filtration thing, and we want to try and preserve it as much as possible.
Another organization that has some ideas on this subject is Greenland's Blue Waters.
Mm-hmm.
But they believe that the Department of Agriculture itself is going to need to be reformed before the dead zone can get fixed. So what's their stance on that?
Well, so I can't really speak too much to the organization itself, but I did speak with a founding member named Wes Jackson. Jackson is a scientist in Salinas, Kansas. He's a plant breeder, works at a place called the Land Institute. And their concept is that we need to develop perennial crops, that this business of ripping up the land every year and replanting is going to get us. And what we need to do is think about what worked pre-colonization. You know, what was the natural ecosystem of this area? And the natural ecosystem were these perennial grasses that had root structures that were 3-4 feet deep. And so what Jackson and others have been doing is trying to breed something based on those plants that stay perennially in the ground, but that produce a grain-like crop. The problem isn't USDA or whatever. The problem is agriculture itself. Mm-hmm. What he wants to do is fix agriculture itself.
Because these perennial plants, this sort of farming would be renewable instead of just constantly sucking everything out of the land.
Right. And, you know, the thing is, look at the system we've got. The system we've got is this World War II influenced thing. So we've got this system where we've got all these fertilizer plants churning out this fertilizer that goes into the ground, that gets washed away. No fertility is maintained. The more fertilizer you use, the more sterile the soil becomes. And it's just sort of a cycle which requires inputs all the way. And I think what Jackson is saying is that let's stop with these endless inputs. Let's try and make it a closed system. And let's have that system be good for the land and for the water.
Paul, do you have any suggestions for Louisiana Eats listeners who want to try and help out with this devastating problem?
Well, there's a few levels of engagement. First of all, and very basic, is eat local seafood. By empowering the local seafood community, I think you are giving them strength and validation that their product matters. I often frame this debate as a situation where we are, in effect, trading seafood away for the sake of land food. I think we need to understand that seafood is precious, and we need to celebrate it, and we need to be prepared to pay for it, and we need to be prepared to defend it. There's also interesting work being done around oyster restoration. Oysters actually can sequester nitrogen. It's slightly controversial as to like how much nitrogen they could actually sequester, but you know they filter out algae. I know that the various baykeeper organizations are doing oyster restoration projects all around Louisiana and Alabama. They actually helped out in Mobile Bay with an oyster reef construction. And what's really amazing is that down where you are, you guys all have lots of oyster spat in the water. Mm-hmm. So all you need to do is build a reef out of oyster shell, and the oysters will set and start rebuilding their business. Yeah, I mean, I think eating well and doing well, good deeds are so much better in a way than just simply paying an indulgence.
Yes.
You know, just paying money to kind of do away with the guilt that you've incurred. And the more you get to know your local environment, the more you understand how fragile it is. I always mourn the fact that people today would much rather watch nature on television than participate in it.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for bringing such exciting new thoughts and really important investigative reporting to Louisiana Eats. We are so glad to have you just a phone call away. Thank you.
My pleasure. Always ready to talk.
Paul Greenberg, investigative environmental reporter and author of the New York Times bestseller, For Fish. Aside from being certified sustainable, Louisiana blue crab meat is some of the sweetest eating to be had. Crab season is at its peak from late spring till early fall, so now's the time to start enjoying our local delicacy. Your first decision is what kind to buy. Lump crab meat is the most expensive and should be reserved for really special presentations. Use those giant lumps of snowy white crab when you're just sautéing the meat or topping it with a little remoulade. The separate lumps are not as defined in the next category, special white crab. So that's the one that's perfect for crab cakes, crab and corn bisque, and crab meat au gratin. The least expensive crab meat comes from the claw. It has the strongest, sweetest, most distinct crab flavor and is just what you want in stuffings and for finishing a gumbo. Speaking of gumbo, when selecting your gumbo crabs, look for the females. They're a little fatter, a little fuller, and often contain that flavorful bright orange roe. To tell the girls from the boys, most people flip them over to look for the all-white underside of the male or the distinctive gray apron of the females, but that's not the only way to tell them apart. Before they're cooked, the male claws are a brilliant blue-green right to the tip. The female's claws are a bright reddish-orange, so she looks like she's been painting her fingernails. For some of our favorite crab recipes, visit the Louisiana Eats website at wwno.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and blue crabs are one of my favorite Louisiana Eats. We'll be right back with an inspirational success story from the shrimp capital of the world, Delcom, Louisiana. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. In Louisiana, there's white shrimp, there's brown shrimp, and now there's a new premium wild-caught shrimp called Vermilion Bay Sweets. Joining us to talk about developing this LSU Ag demonstration project is seafood specialist Dr. John Bell and coastal agent Thomas Emel. John and Thomas, welcome.
Oh, good to see you. Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Well, how did this project come about?
In Delcom. Delcom, we have our Delcom Direct Seafood Program where we have our fishermen that sell direct to the public, and that project's really been going well. But during the off-season, we wanted to offer something else, a local branded pack of shrimp ready to go. So what we did, we challenged ourselves to let's produce the highest-end, top-shelf, gourmet-type pack we can do and do it with some of the most difficult folks to kind of work with. Okay, so that's what
Shrimpers.
So, and we worked
shrimp
with
processors.
Shrimp processors, all in that. So we went down to Intracoastal City, and we worked at a Vietnamese dock. We have a field agent that's Vietnamese. So we went down there, and we laid out the story. They bought in, and then we put our team together. So that's the type of shrimp we wanted to work with. We wanted to work with those fishermen, and then we figured if we could pull it off with that group, we could do it with anybody.
And I'm the food scientist backing this up and the technologist, but the part that really talked to me is that Tom put this group together to create this best demonstration product where everything is linked. We have the food safety part of it. I work with a processor to make sure that they had all their HACCP and documentation and their controls all the way back to the fisherman who is doing everything right on board.
What is a demonstration project? That was, you know, I really had never heard that term before.
Well, that's how we do things in the university. Our job with doing this was to show these folks, our fishing clientele, that they could do this. So we wanted to produce this pack. We wanted it to be locally branded, sort of a boutique processing thing where a small group of people could do it with no machinery. So we sat around, we figured it out.
And of course, the key is it has to be a premium quality pack, so it will stand out and deliver to the customer who catches the marketing and is excited by all this, and then they get a very high-quality product, and that helps differentiate it even further.
And Thomas, if you would walk us through the process and the period of time from the time that the shrimp are in the net until they're processed and frozen. Just take us through that.
Okay, the process, the boat will be out in the Gulf nearshore waters or offshore, and they'll be harvesting white shrimp. They'll pull the net for about 2 hours. They'll pick up the net. They'll sort through the shrimp, and they will freeze them in the crawfish sacks. Those will go in the freezer, and they'll be out for maybe a month, 6 weeks. The boat will come into the dock. They'll unload all of these bags where the dock owner will then weigh each bag and check the count to see what size shrimp there are in those bags, because they pay based on count, how many shrimp pieces per pound. And the bigger they are, the more they're worth. Mm-hmm. That's just the shrimp world.
Just like diamonds.
Just like that. Then at the plant, what they'll do is they'll take those shrimp. Now, these are head-on shrimp.
Right.
They'll put them in a big vat and thaw them out. They bring them into the processing room where they remove the heads, and then they hand peel them, hand devein them, and vacuum pack them. It's all done by hand.
And why don't you point out, too, about the, who owns it, the brand?
Yeah, this is interesting how we put all this together, is that because we developed this with some grant money that was available through the Port of Delcom, the port owns the brand, and then Gulf South Inc., the Vietnamese group, they pack this under a license. So essentially, the port gets 10 cents a pack, and they use that to market the product. So, you know, it's because that's what ports do, is help their constituency. That's how this is done.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Thanks, Poppy.
Thank you so much.
John Bell and Thomas Emel of the LSU Ag Demonstration Project, Vermilion Bay Sweets. Benson, founding editor of Louisiana Kitchen and Culture magazine, has an amazing knack for unearthing the most delicious things our state has to offer. Jill, welcome back, and what's on your plate today?
Poppy, there's charcuterie from Bourgeois Meat Market in Schriever. Bourgeois Meat Market was established in 1881, and it took me a while to get there. But on a recent Friday, my long-suffering husband Andrew and I were on our way to a dinner at the John Fulce Culinary Institute at Nichols State. My friend David Gallant had told me about the beef jerky. So I went to Bourgeois in search of the beef jerky, and I was able to secure a pound of it, but they were out of pretty much everything else. They're known for their andouille, their boudin noir, their boudin blanc, tasso head cheese, everything. Well, I later learned it's their goal to be out of absolutely everything by Saturday, but we'll get back to that.
Okay.
What they were not out of was something that intrigued me.
What?
It was called turkey cheese.
Turkey cheese. You got me, Jill.
Turkey cheese. It had me, too. So what, pray tell, is turkey cheese? And Beau Bourgeois told me that his dad, Donald, started making turkey cheese in the late 80s as a healthier version of hogshead cheese. And turkey cheese, which comes in hot and mild varieties, he says it's really popular with the oil field workers because they use it to bribe secretaries when they want to get in to see someone. Anyway, we were on our way to the dinner at the John Fulce Culinary Institute, but we were starving. Uh-huh. So we picked up a half a pound of turkey cheese and a roll of saltine crackers, and we decided to have a nibble in the car. Mm-hmm. We were blown away by the stuff. We went back the next day and we bought several pounds of it that went into the freezer.
What was the difference that you perceived between hogshead cheese that we're accustomed to eating and turkey cheese?
The texture was very much the same. It was less gelatinous, of course, than hogshead cheese would be. For me, there was a cleaner flavor. But
and obviously, it's better for you. So.
Allegedly, it's better for you. But several things interested me about Bourgeois Meat Market. There was a man with several bottles of this mustard. He must have had five bottles, large bottles of this mustard. It's Bourgeois TTS. It's totally top secret mustard. It's ambrosia in a bottle. I mean, it is.
What can you compare it to?
There is no product I could really compare this to. It has a more liquid texture than a typical mustard from a jar. There's a spicy element to it. I taste a little bit of turmeric in there, a little bit of brown sugar. There's some vinegar, but they're not giving up the recipe.
Okay.
All right. Here's what I thought of this mustard. Saw this man with five bottles of it, so we had to grab a bottle.
Of course. This goes
really well with that turkey cheese, by the way. And again, this is something that Donald Bourgeois came up with a few years ago, about 8 years ago. This guy's an idea man. So what I want to do with this mustard, I want to inject a turkey with this mm-hmm. and let it sit for 24 hours, then fry it. I'm thinking this would be incredible. Last night, I dunked some fried chicken in it, and I ate it over the sink. I think it would also be good on a finger, and I suspect that it would work on an old tire, too.
Oh, my God.
This is great. So I can't say enough about Donald Bourgeois. I've never met the man, but he seems to be brilliant. He was awakened recently with an idea for boudin burritos. This is their new thing. The ingredients are a flour tortilla and boudin. That's it. But there, and Bo agrees, there's something transformative about these.
Wow.
They sell for about $1.50 and they are addictive.
Well, a testimonial if I ever heard one. Thank you so much for coming to see us, and please come back soon.
Absolutely, Poppy.
Founding editor of Louisiana Kitchen and Culture magazine, Jill Benson, our Louisiana Eats roving reporter.
On the road again, going places that I've never been, seeing things that I may never see again. I can't wait to get on the road again.
Chef Tenny Flynn of G.W. Finn's restaurant is well known for his fresh, delicious seafood. G.W. Finn's is often a destination also for both visiting and homegrown celebrities. Tenny, welcome back to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you for having me.
So we were discussing seafood the other day, and you brought up a very surprising ingredient that I don't think a lot of people would expect to hear that you've been cooking with here sometimes at G.W. Finn. So what have you been cooking lately, Tenny?
Well, this is not ever going to be on the menu here. I'll say that. This is something that we brought in special for a special person. The special person is Dr. John.
And what is it that he loves to eat?
Raccoon.
Raccoon. How did you discover this?
Well, one of my purveyors, Roy Hughes, I buy shrimp and crab meat and soft shells from Roy. Roy is buddies with Dr. John. And he wanted to bring him in. He brought him in, and, you know, he has a very restricted diet. And he only eats wild food. And what he really wanted was a raccoon. And I, you know, started casting out for sourcing a raccoon. And everybody could get me one, but nobody did. So a buddy of mine shot a nutria and some pooldew. Mm-hmm. So I made Dr. John a pooldew gumbo, you know, with the gizzards and the thighs and the breast, and he wanted chicken feet in it, nice soft chicken feet cooked Asian style, and really knocked myself out, made a nice gumbo, and then got it out to the table, and he goes, "Did you use buckwheat flour in the roux?" I'm thinking, buckwheat flour? Nobody eats buckwheat flour unless they don't have anything else. I mean, if you're on the steppes of Russia or something and that's all that grows. But I said, no, I didn't use buckwheat flour. And I'm thinking, you know, what this guy used to do for about 30 years, I don't think a little white flour is going to kill him.
But,
you know,
I doubt
it. Anyway, I said, well, I'll pick the meat out. You can eat the meat and your nutria is coming out. And I brined the nutria and I cooked it in a sauce piquant till it was tender. And, you know, you could cook a telephone book that way. And it would be pretty good. And in the meantime, I started getting the raccoons.
And so where are these raccoons coming from?
Well, people trap them.
Okay. And, in their backyards and everything,
I really don't know. It's not, you can't sell game in a restaurant anyway.
Right.
You know, I'm giving this away to some.
It's a love gift for Dr. John.
Well, right. And the first one I cooked sort of like the nutria. I brined it. And then I browned it off and cooked it in a kind of a spicy brown gravy with red wine and anchovies, you know, just in case it didn't taste good.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty good. And I tasted some pieces of it, and I said, well, the next one I get, I'm not going to cook as aggressively. And then I got two, and I gave one to one of my Mexican ladies who took it home and cooked it, I think, the way they cook pretty much everything. You put it in a pot full of hot chilies and boil it for a while. Very good, very spicy. And then the last one I cooked sort of like a boiled beef. I made some coon stock and cooked it and made some coon broth and some root vegetables. So it's a nice, you know, the natural flavor is coming out. So he's going to come in and he's going to have coon three ways.
Oh, my gosh, he's going to be happy. You're going to have.
Well, I hope so. He's a lot of fun. And, you know, God knows we love our characters here, and he certainly is one.
What do you think to your average outdoorsman who brings a coon home to his wife, what do you think the greatest challenges are going to be in cooking that?
I never had a wife that I could bring a coon home to. Maybe. But anyway, I got the old L.O. Bean Game and Fish cookbook. I mean, it's got recipes for beavers and muskrats and groundhogs and porcupines. And pretty much they start off, soak them overnight in salt water, which is a brine.
Yes. And what does that do for it?
Well, it seasons it. It makes it juicier. It works real well for meat that doesn't have a lot of fat.
Well, I know that you grew up in North Carolina, so were there raccoons in your past?
And actually, it was in West Virginia. My grandparents and my cousins would go coon hunting with dogs. So I've eaten that, and I have eaten a possum. And, you know, I was discussing that with Dr. John, and he goes, "I ain't never eat a possum." So, you know, maybe there's a possum in his future, too.
Well, tell me, is this the most unusual accommodation that you've ever had to make for a celebrity guest?
I would say so. And, you know, it's not a, it's not really an accommodation. I mean, we try to honor anybody's special request. And, you know, I'm a fan. I like his music, so.
Well, celebrity guests, where do you draw the line?
We don't draw a line with anybody that I can think of. You know, we'll bend over backwards. Now we're back there in the kitchen yelling and screaming, you know, about crazy people and their ridiculous dietary requests, but we try to accommodate them.
So everybody's a celebrity at GWFN.
Well, Morgan Freeman likes room temperature vodka, and he wants his olives stuffed with raw garlic. And you have to macerate the olives in vodka ahead of time, and then put them in the, and I forget what brand of vodka it is. I'm sure it's a top shelf one.
I would think.
But he likes that. So that's not really that big of a deal. But he comes in often when he's filming here. And like all good New Orleanians, you know, we don't bother them.
No, that's why they like it here.
You know, we leave them alone. And if they approach us, we'll be happy to talk to them. But just treat them like normal folks.
Well, thank you so much, Tenney. I know that all normal folks have a really special time here at GWFN's, and I can't wait to come back and have some more of your yummy food. Thank you.
Well, thanks for coming in, and certainly welcome anytime.
Chef Tenney Flynn of GWFN's, who also knows how to cook a mean raccoon. Chef Ryan Hughes is our Louisiana Eats taste specialist, and he always has some new ingredient up his sleeve. So, Ryan, what do you have for us today?
Ooh, I like the term taste specialist. I like it. Maybe I can put that on my chef jacket. Chef
oh,
Ryan
don't get
Hughes,
too carried
taste
away.
Specialist.
Ryan, what are we tasting?
Today, we're going to taste a new ingredient I just discovered, and it's called a finger lime. I was turned on to it not too long ago by Chef Cristobar at Serendipity. He gave it to me, and I literally thought he was handing me a small pickle like a gherkin. And I'm okay, we've got gherkins here.
That's Chris for you.
It's cool. I got you. All right, we can play with the gherkin, sure.
He uses some crazy ingredients.
Yes, he does. And he showed me. He took a paring knife and slid it all the way up the side. And I'm like, okay, this is – you've got my attention now. And opened it up. And it looked like, the only way I can describe it is, you know, when you're a kid, you had those Nerds candies, like those little tiny little – pebbles or whatnot.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was probably 60 or 80 of them inside this inch and a half, 2-inch gherkin looking thing. And so he split it open, ran your thumb through it, and kind of started pumping them out of there. You know, they kind of push out of there. And what they were these amazing little capsules of a lime burst in your mouth, you know?
Wow.
So we started playing around with it. We put it on top of the meringue. I found out where he was getting it from, which was actually the Pacific Northwest out in Oregon. I ordered a pound of them and came in, and I started using them in salads. They were amazing.
Yum.
Absolutely amazing. I did a crab salad with fresh hearts of palm. And what I did was I took the finger limes and scraped them and just tossed them with the crab. So you take an interesting ingredient like that and you put it in there where people aren't normally going to order it, right? Mm-hmm. They see finger limes on there like, well, I'm going for the crab.
Yeah, that could frighten them.
It could frighten somebody. You really don't know, but you pair it with something that is really easy. I walked out there and there was these two elderly ladies and regular customers, and I watched their face and I watched their expressions, and they were eating the crab salad, and the one lady goes, her eyes just lit up like that. Another lady was kind of confused and she ate it. But that is the magical moment that all of us chefs strive for.
Oh, absolutely.
Is you turn on somebody that would not normally have something like that, and they got it. They understood what you're trying to do. So it was this pop of flavor that mixed well with the crab. And of course, they came back once a week. Then they always had to have the crab salad.
Well, thank you so much for turning on all of our Louisiana Eats listeners to this new ingredient, finger limes. I got one last question for
you, Ryan.
Of course,
yes, yes.
Is it zestable, or are you only utilizing the inside of
you
the
can
finger
only,
lime?
That's a great question, Poppy. You only utilize the inside. The outside, it's kind of squishy. I don't know. Maybe I'll go home and try zesting a few finger limes.
Okay. Well, let me know what happens, all right?
I will. I'll get back with you on that one.
Come back soon.
Yes, of course.
Chef Ryan Hughes, our Louisiana Eats flavor consultant. Come back, Dr. Gourmet will give us the lowdown on cholesterol in our daily diet. As usual, he's got some delicious and good advice. Stay with us. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's culinary heritage hero was just 22 years old when she came to New Orleans from Germany in 1853 to join her brother, who worked as a butcher in the New Orleans French Market. She married a Mr. Dutrille, who had worked as a butcher but owned a coffee shop across the street from the market, where she began to serve her brothers and his butcher friends a big late morning meal. After Mr. Dutrille's death, this thoroughly modern woman married the bartender, a man 8 years her junior, who with her continued to operate what had now become a well-known restaurant. By the time of the Cotton Exposition in 1884 and 5, our culinary heritage hero was the number one tourist attraction in New Orleans. Visitors wrote months in advance for reservations. In 1900, the Southern Pacific Railroad persuaded her to share her recipes, which were published in a book intended to be more of a tourist guide than an actual cookbook. Her 1906 death was national news. The Times-Picayune called her the Queen of Culinary Arts, and the New York, Chicago, and Dallas papers all noted her passing as well. This week's Culinary Heritage Hero, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, is Madame Elizabeth Begay, who originated Breakfast at Begay's, the late morning meal we all now call brunch. I'm Poppy Tooker, and Breakfast at Begay's is real Louisiana Eats. Cholesterol. If you've had a not-so-positive conversation with your doctor about your cholesterol numbers, this word could strike fear into your heart. But our friend, Louisiana Eats medical consultant Dr. Gourmet, is here to help us better understand this whole issue. Tim, welcome back.
It is great to be with you, Poppy.
Let's start with good versus bad when it comes to cholesterol.
Well, actually, I want to start with something a little different, Poppy, because when I talk about cholesterol, most people think the cholesterol that's in food you eat. Okay,
yeah.
So that's dietary cholesterol, like in eggs and shrimp and yummy lobster, etc. Liver, big
yes.
fan of liver. So that's dietary cholesterol. That's the food that you eat that contains cholesterol. Okay, remember
okay.
that? Set it aside for a minute. The
second
is what we doctors call serum cholesterol, which is when you go to the doctor and they jab you in the arm and they draw some blood and they send it to the lab and they get a cholesterol profile.
Mm-hmm.
That is your reading of how high your cholesterol is in your own bloodstream. That is serum cholesterol versus dietary cholesterol. Now, you know, the thing is that we know that serum cholesterol profiles, like HDL cholesterol, high-density lipoprotein, that's very good for you.
Right.
Okay, so you want that one to be super high.
What does that do for you?
Well, it actually helps clear atherosclerotic plaques, so it actually can help reverse or prevent the buildup of heart disease or atherosclerosis, hardening of the arteries.
So what are the greatest myths?
Well, I think the greatest myth right now is that the dietary cholesterol that I started with raises your serum cholesterol or adversely affects your serum cholesterol. We now know that actually very few of us, probably only about 8 to 10% of us, when we eat something that's high in cholesterol, that it will actually raise our serum cholesterol. Okay?
Okay.
So it's a little bit of a myth that that egg is bad for you. In fact, it's a big myth. It's a myth that that shrimp is bad for you because it has high cholesterol. It's a myth that the liver, I love liver, bad for you. It is actually really good for you. And a lot of these foods have either great quality fats in them, like the eggs, or they have low fat, you know, for instance, like the shrimp or the lobster, or they've got other terrific things like iron, et cetera, in the liver. So very few of us actually, when we consume something that's high in cholesterol, will it affect our serum cholesterol. The problem is, I can't sit here and tell you who that is.
Well, part of it's a genetic proclivity, isn't it?
It is. It is that. So we call those people hyper responders. But there's no blood test or anything for whether or not you're a hyper responder. So when patients come to me and I start talking to them about, you know, eating great food, eating healthier, what we really focus on these days is eating great quality fats and higher fiber. Those are the two things that can have the most impact on serum cholesterol. Great quality fats, meaning lower saturated fat, and better quality fats or higher monounsaturated fats, polyunsaturated fats like olive oil, grapeseed oil, canola oil, etc. So it's about eating better quality fats and lots of fiber. Those are the two dietary things that actually will affect your cholesterol the most.
Well, we see so much nowadays about cholesterol meds. I've seen crazy things about inordinately high numbers of MDs who have put themselves on like Lipitor. Tell me about all this medicine.
They're great, and they clearly do prevent heart attack. They prevent stroke. They help prevent second heart attack. They're very necessary and a major part of my toolbox. But as you know, the first part of my toolbox is always going to be make some changes in your life. So I spend time, and this is what we've talked about teaching the med students to do, spending a little bit of time talking about cholesterol, saturated fat, better quality diet, higher fiber diet, et cetera, making those changes. And then the other thing that affects serum cholesterol tremendously is exercise.
Well, I just love your prescriptions because they always sound delicious. Thank you so much for the cholesterol talk today. That's
because they almost always involve food.
Thank you. Louisiana Eats medical consultant, Dr. Gourmet Tim Harlan. Chef Gerard Maris has helped shape the new Creole cuisine of New Orleans since he first arrived at Commander's Palace in 1981. Later, at his own restaurant, Gerard's, he trained a legion of some of the hottest young chefs of today. Gerard teaches classes at the New Orleans Cooking Experience, and that's where I learned about his unusual technique for boiling shrimp. Gerard, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Hey, Poppy, how you doing?
I'm great, and I'm thrilled to have you on the phone. So tell me, how do you boil shrimp?
Well, I'll tell you what. Not very long ago, probably a year ago, a year and a half ago, I talked to another one of my favorite chefs, Kevin Vizard, and we were just chatting, and he was talking about what he calls a reverse method. And what he does is he makes a boil, and then he chills that boil down, gets it very, very cold. So I started doing that when I'm doing small amounts of shrimp, or I'm doing a salad, or I'm doing a remoulade, or I'm doing just marinated boiled shrimp. And what I do is I make this boil up, and I make my own recipe, but you could probably use the Zatarain's or whatever, and I get it very cold. And sometimes I'll actually freeze pint containers of it. After that, what you want to do is you want to boil your shrimp in salt water. As soon as they're done, being sure not to overcook them, you take them out and you chill them in that boil and let them sit for about 10 minutes. and that stops the cooking, and they start absorbing all that flavor.
You know, I think one of the mistakes people make when they're boiling shrimp is they overcook them.
Exactly.
So do you put the shrimp in the salted water and heat it to the boil, or do you plunge them into the boiling salted water?
I plunge them into the boiling water, and what I do is if you have like 5 pounds of shrimp, you don't want to add them all at one time. Add like a pound at a time and let that heat remain. Let it keep on boiling. Once it barely comes up to a boil, you turn it off, let it set for a minute or two. It takes a very short amount of time. And then you strain them out, put them in that ice-cold boil, and let them sit for about 10 minutes. And then you can take them out and eat them immediately because they're chilled. And a lot of times what I'll do is I'll take them out, strain them, drizzle them with a little bit of olive oil, some crushed red pepper, and some fresh herbs, and use them on my salads.
Oh, that sounds delicious. Now, I think you told me recently that you've also started maybe having some blocks of this frozen boil.
Right. What I'll do is sometimes when I know I'm going to be boiling shrimp, and right now I'm seeing pickup trucks on the side of the road selling fresh shrimp, so that's a good sign. I'll go ahead and I'll make up a big batch of the boil, and I'll freeze up pint containers of it, and then I'll let it kind of partially thaw, and then when the shrimp come out of that hot salt water, go right in there, it chills them immediately, it stops the cooking, and it sucks up all that good flavor.
I bet that makes them easier to peel, too, doesn't it?
Well, you can do them peeled or unpeeled. I do them both ways. But if you're going to do a peeled shrimp, it's even better because the shrimp don't get a chance to overcook. They keep that nice texture. They're white. They're really refreshing tasting.
That's incredible. See, I always thought it was better to boil them in the peels with the heads on. That's what I'm always thinking. It's amazing to hear that you do it this other way. Now, Gerard, what do you think some of the most important things about boiling shrimp are?
Well, first of all, you have to have the absolutely freshest shrimp. And this time of year, that's very easy in Louisiana. You can pick them up at our local grocery stores. You can get them from fish markets. You can get them off the side of the road. But you want them absolutely fresh. You want to see behind that head that there's plenty of that coral orange color, just beautiful, firm shrimp.
You don't want them out the freezer then?
Ideally not. I mean, sometimes there are some good IQF products that are available in the off season, but right now there's no reason to buy those.
For those who might not know, what does that mean, IQF?
IQF is individually quick frozen. They're frozen immediately, and generally they're a very good product that we use in the off season. But in the season, the chefs are always using the fresh.
I've got one more question to ask you about that boil. Now, everybody has their own secret ingredients that they put into the boiling liquid. Would you give us a rundown of some of the flavors you like to include?
Well, I always use a little bit of salt. I like using black pepper. I use a moderate amount of cayenne, but I like the crushed red. And when I have jalapenos in the garden, I'll put a few jalapenos in there. But some of the things that I add that probably aren't as usual would be like whole cloves, allspice, and crushed fennel. And it gives it that interesting taste.
Well, thank you, Gerard. Thanks so much for taking time out from your busy life at the farm to chat with us.
You're more than welcome.
Chef Gerard Maris and his Louisiana boiled shrimp.
All I do every day is work. Every time, every way, I work. It's time for me to take a break. I'm getting tired, for heaven's sake.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we talk food with comedian Jeff Foxworthy.
Bakers are kind. By nature, they're givers because this thing that they do, that they love to do, they do it to give away. They don't keep it for themselves. They bake all this stuff and then give it to their families and their neighbors and their friends. And so, you know, I thought, yeah, that's kind of right up my alley.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company, Lightsegan and Westside Lightsegan Funeral Homes, LCI Workers' Comp, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to producer and sound engineer Thomas Walsh. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.